Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. My name is Kaveh Hoda, Dr. Kaveh Hoda. It's not that important that you call me doctor, but I'm just saying it's true. And I am the host of this little medical podcast, this fun little humor adjacent medical podcast that examines the intersections of public health and politics and pop culture and whatever else I want to talk about. But first, before we get to the show, I'm excited. We have new sponsors. Devlin McGregor Pharmaceuticals and their new medication, Provasic, the product of a 17-year development process that is described as a non-statin drug that harmonizes cholesterol and blood lipoproteins. Side effects may include allergic reaction, extensive bleeding, shock, being framed for the death of your wife by once-trusted colleagues, train crashes, subway fights, and being chased on a nationwide manhunt. Provasic. Okay, getting to the show. I have two special guests with me today. First, we have fellow podcaster, someone who's deep in the bowels of the podcasting world, like myself, Zach Van Nuss. Zach, welcome to the show for the first time. Welcome to the show, buddy.
Kaveh, it is good, so good to see you again. It's been, I think, 6 months since we've talked. So
been too long.
Yeah.
Too long if you ask me, and you didn't ask me. But if you did, I would have said it's too long.
And I would agree.
Zach Finn, can you tell people where what podcast you do? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I host a show called Grinding to a Halt. It is an anti-grindset podcast. I know this show is more medical focused. So I'm in the second most noble profession, which is digital marketing. Which is
you're the real hero here.
Congratulations on the sponsor. That's a big win. So it is conversations with
that people. Company's a monster, just so you know.
It is
switch the samples, right?
Stay out of here, second guest. You're not invited on yet. Wait.
So my show is conversations with people about what they do for work, who they are as people, how they find the balance in between. Really, it's just anyone I find interesting, bring them on, have a conversation. You were episode one, so it is nice to be on your show.
It's nice to have you, buddy. It's a good show. I do recommend everyone listen to it as soon as you're done listening to this podcast. But Zach, how you haven't done a lot of research into long COVID, I'm going to assume, correct?
Other than having it, no, mm-hmm. No.
Okay. Long COVID? were you told you had long COVID or just COVID?
Long COVID.
All right. Very interesting. So, yeah. Well, then it's perfect that you're here today because we are going to talk to somebody who does know something about long COVID, who knows a lot about a lot of things. My good friend, he's very, very smart. He's very handsome. He's a very charming doctor, Harvard ER physician, Substacker public health researcher and expert, Dr. Jeremy Faust. Can I call you Jeremy?
I think we've gone on to the first name basis, and I'm going to stop calling you Chuckles. I'll start calling you your real name.
Why? Yeah, wait. Before we recorded, we were talking about the worst pronunciation of my name that I heard, and the worst I ever got was Chavers. It was Chavers is what I was called. Yeah, not Chuckles. Chuckles would be kind of cool, though, if I'm being honest. That would be pretty cool. Dr. Faust, Jeremy, welcome back to the show. It's been so long. I missed you, buddy.
It's so good to be here, and you fulfilled my dream. We could just do the entire show of a fugitive quotes. That would be my dream.
You know what's really disturbing? I barely had to look that up. Yeah. I haven't seen that movie in years, and I was able to get that like stuff pretty quickly. It's pretty wild how that stuck with me. That was really like, we must have been at the right age for that to get in our brains or something, because that's deep in there for me.
Jane Lynch plays the doc, you know, not a comedic role.
Right. Yeah. She was the one that, she was like the good doctor friend, right? Man, not the bad doctor friend. Yeah. We could do a whole show about that, but we're not. We're going to talk about long COVID today, a serious and significant growing problem in this country. So you have written about this. You've looked into this. You are up to date on the most recent data regarding long COVID. So let's just start with the very, very basics. What is the definition, if there is one, of long COVID?
Yeah, so there are lots of competing definitions, and so I don't want to give just one, but the one that I think people often refer to is the WHO, which, you know, combines a certain number of symptoms with a certain amount of time, so that you're not necessarily going to have long COVID after 1 month. It might be 60, 90, 120 days, and that there's no other explanation. The thing that I think people are really struggling with is that they've tried to use big research databases to sort of back calculate, like, oh, what are the big symptoms that are associated with long COVID? And it turns out that it's just not that easy, because there might be more than one of these. There might be subtypes. I think that there's probably a pre-vaccine version. There's a post-vaccine version. It depends on who you are. So, I think that, I'm going to punt and say that the definitions are still out there. And in fact, just about a year ago, I gave a talk at the National Academy of Sciences. That's a little, you know.
That was nice. Little nice name drop.
Humble brag, yeah, there.
Nice.
Yeah, I just picked that up off the floor there. Where they were having a whole symposium about definitions. And they invited me to talk about the tension between the various factions, so we could go into that. So, because actually it matters where you draw lines and what you're trying to get out of it.
Yeah, tell me, what do you mean by tension? Tension between different groups of people trying to define it separately and differently?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's the scientific tension is that the more inclusive you are, the broader you are, the better in some way, because you don't miss any cases and you don't tell somebody who's suffering, oh, sorry, you don't have this thing, so we're not going to pay attention to you. So that's like on the advocacy side of like, leave nobody behind. On the science side, the scientists actually say, you know what, we would actually like to narrow this definition and really zoom in on a certain population, because that'll make it easier for us to figure out how to measure it, how to treat it. And so that's what I was really going to talk to them about, was this idea that actually, weirdly, the more inclusive you are, the easier it is to miss the opportunity to find a therapeutic. You will actually dismiss things that work and rule out things that don't. And so there's this huge tension of like, what are you trying to do? Validate people, include them, identify them, or help scientists find a path forward.
Mm-hmm. So I know, as you mentioned, there's still a lot to learn about this, and we're still early in the process, but do you have in your mind, is there certain things that you need to see for you to feel, yeah, this is long COVID?
Well, I don't diagnose long COVID as an ER doctor. I'll just be very, very honest. What I think, looking through the literature, there's a lot of mechanisms being discussed. There are a lot of biomarkers like blood tests or other things they might find. And so I think that I am looking for, you know, high quality research, you know, when you see it, is there a control group? Are we factoring out confounding variables because we don't want to mix things up? And so, I think there was a recent paper that came out that looked at, like, for example, this idea of persistent genetic material hanging out in the body. And we could talk about why I thought that was actually really, there was some compelling stuff there, mm-hmm. but also some misunderstandings. But I always say if you're going to describe something, you'd best have a really, really good control group because you don't want to mix things up. And, you know, you want to also be aware of some, you know, this p-hacking thing where we check for 1,000 things and, you know, 1 in 20 of them are going to be in the 95th percentile. Mm-hmm. So you got to be really, really careful because, again, it's not what you don't know. It's what you think you know that's wrong that will end us, you know, and put us in a real bad spot.
Zach, when you were told you had long COVID, was it based on something particular that triggered whoever gave you that diagnosis, like a test or lab result? Or was it just a constellation of symptoms and they're like, this seems like you have long COVID?
Yeah, so for mine, it was a combination of long-term symptoms. So I was one of those lucky people who in beginning of April of 2020, I had COVID. So, and like immediately I went from feeling fine to 105 temperature. We called the hospital and they're like, well, don't take anything because we don't know if stuff will kill you. So like, don't take aspirin, don't take Tylenol, sweat it out. And then I had 101 fever for 5 straight days. Couldn't breathe, just laid in bed. At one point I texted my wife and I was like, I think I might die tonight. Like legitimately, this could be it. Like, and it was terrifying. Nobody knew what was happening. About 2 weeks later, I started to feel better. I had the long-term, just fatigue. And then still to this day, now, 4 years later, my lungs never fully recovered. So I went from running 4 to 5 miles every day to I can run about 100 yards and my lungs just stop. I have not been able to rebuild any lung capacity. Heart rate, I will just be sitting down and my heart rate will just spike. It'll jump up to like 180 and then it'll drop back down and then it'll spike back up and then go back down. So like those, I tried to blame my hair loss on it as well. I've been told maybe that's not COVID, but I don't want to own that one. But those were the main ones of like, your lungs just unable to rebuild the lung capacity I had previously. And then weird.
You just
heart
never
rate
felt
fluctuates.
Like you recovered fully either.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
No.
Can I say something so interesting? Yeah. I think that there are so many things that people have floated to like treat acute COVID and some things that are out of left field and some things that to treat long COVID. But what I do think is that this virus breaks people's brains in a way that I don't quite understand. Like the idea that people were telling, I remember this, they were saying, oh, don't take Tylenol or ibuprofen. Mm-hmm. It's a virus.
Yeah.
It's a very bad virus. It is a virus to which we have no immunity to so far. But like, it's not like from outer space. Like,
exactly.
Well, do you know why I think that happened? Why I remember that being a thing was the French, like a high ranking French, like science officer came out and was like, oh, we're doing a preliminary study. It looks like people who use Advil are doing, or NSAIDs, like ibuprofen, are doing worse. And I think that freaked everyone out. But in reality, I'm sure it was just because they were the sickest people and they were just taking lots of medication to try and fix it. So I remember that distinctly what you're talking about.
And by the sickest people, you mean the French, correct?
They mean sick, yes. Deeply sick. I'll say this because of Europe, they have some of my least listeners are in France. So I feel comfortable saying that.
Perfect.
Yeah. So actually, let me ask you another question, Jeremy. I feel like the topic of long COVID, when we first started discussing it, wasn't really accepted by most physicians. I think a lot of physicians were like, I don't know. Is it really a thing? Maybe this is just some sort of like mental thing, whatever. Do you feel it's more accepted now generally by physicians?
It's definitely more accepted now. But I also think that from the get-go, there were a couple of different camps. And I'll tell you which camp I was in. I was in the, of course there's long COVID because there's probably long everything. And this is the virus to which we have the least immunity to, and we're going to, and it's the most damn contagious of anything we've seen in a long time. And so basically like you put like the, okay, it's in the top 1% of how bad it makes us sick right now. It's in the top 1% of how contagious it is, so it's going to show up everywhere. And it's probably in the top like quarter or 10% or something like that of viruses that can cause a longer syndrome. You put those three things together, and it's going to be very, very common. But on top of that, you know, yeah, there's always going to be, you know, questions about, you know, oh, is it in your head or whatever? And I think that there was some suspicion there, but I think there's been a lot of data that has come out that has shown, at least in my view, that there is a large cohort of people who have something that's not in your head, right? And I think that I'll tell you just anecdotally, which is the best evidence in the world, by the way. I don't know if you know that. Anecdotal evidence is a gold standard. That before the vaccine, we saw patients who had really, really bad x-rays on their chest. They had bad CAT scans. I remember this. They weren't even being tested for COVID. They were there for like, I have abdominal pain. And they had like, whatever, a pancreas, you know, they had pancreatitis. So it's unrelated. Oh, by the way, your lungs look like a disaster zone. Do you happen to have COVID? No, I feel fine. And you test them and they're positive. And so I think there was some degree of like really bad lung injury to some people who didn't even know they had symptoms. You had symptoms.
Yeah.
But like, I think there are some people who just don't, it was sort of subclinical, but if you actually look in their lungs pre-vaccine, it's like, wow, there's something going on there.
It did damage. Zach, do you feel like people, when you tell them you have long COVID do you feel like you still have, you feel like you still have long COVID, right? You don't feel like like grew out of. Do you feel like when you tell people that, some people it's kind of in your head. Have you tried yoga?
Yeah, I think there is kind of that 50-50 split of people who are like, yeah, that sucks. I'm sorry you have that. And then the other ones are like, well, you're just older now. So of course you don't have the lung capacity you had. Of course you can't run the way you used to run. Mm. And they just kind of want to write it off, which is frustrating, you know, to say the least. But those are people that tend to be more on the side of, well, I don't need the vaccine because I already had COVID once. So like, you know, I'm in the clear. Mm. It's people who I don't really trust what they say too much anyway.
I actually wonder also what the epidemiology in terms of like how common this is, like how, again, pre-vaccine versus vaccine kinds of categories. And I think that one of the things that turns people's heads, brains off in a sort of unfortunate way is when you see things like, oh, 40% of people who have COVID get long COVID, 30% of people who get COVID, which, and then you look around and you're like, I know a lot of people. I know a few who have long COVID, but it sure ain't 40%. And so they hear that and they just think, oh, this is just completely nuts. I don't have to pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So you discuss this in your Substack. Can you tell us a little bit about the proposed mechanisms behind this, how this happens, long COVID?
Yeah. So I think that there are really like three big old buckets, the way I think about it. One is the nuclear bomb fallout kind of scorched earth. That is, you, April 2020, you get an infection to which you have no immunity. Your body just, it's an autoimmune, but also a viral response. It's just like a bomb went off. And it's just going to take a long time and maybe never fully recover from that. It's scorched earth, right? It's just a battlefield in there. And it's just going to take time and maybe inevitably, you know, who knows? Like, when do you get back to normal? Who knows? That's kind of one theory. And one thing supporting that is that in at least some literature, like the higher your viral loads were early on, the more likely you are to have long COVID later. Mm-hmm. So that's like one. The second one, which I think is really the one that I'm beginning to become really interested in, not at the exclusion of the other ones, but just I'm really more interested in like learning about this, is persistent fragments. I call this the bee sting. That is, you know, the virus does its thing, it clears, but left behind is some little stinger somewhere. It's hanging out in a lymph node or hanging out in some tissue. And that activates your immune system in a way that's causing symptoms. That stuff can be protein from the virus, like the spike protein, or it could be genetic material. And I can dig in a little bit more about that. And I think I'm really beginning to be convinced that this is not a commonly held view, but I believe that our bodies intentionally keep around some degree of genetic material from a recent RNA virus to keep our immune systems primed, to keep it on ready, and that long COVID just may be a pathologic extreme of that. So that a lot of viruses do this. I was talking to Ziad Alali recently, who's a COVID researcher, and Ziad and I were talking about this, and he's like, well, how come other viruses don't do this? And I'm like, they do. We just haven't looked that much. I spent like an hour on the internet the other day, and it's flu, and it's all these other viruses, measles. And so, in fact, I think if we start looking, we'll see this happening a lot. And it's just like too much of a good thing, like all autoimmune diseases. Okay. And then the third one is sort of the persistent live virus. That is like, it's like HIV. It's in my body. It's replicating and it's hiding. I think that's the one that has the least direct evidence and biggest uphill climb, but I don't think you can rule it out at this point. But everything that I've seen so far that seems to suggest that, when I look closer, it didn't rule it out, but it wasn't like, that wasn't like what it was saying.
That's interesting. So, I mean, and it's very possible that these aren't maybe three distinct things happening. There may be a spectrum, and there's maybe even different things happening for different people. Even this is really a moving target, is kind of the sense I'm getting from it. Is that your sense too?
Yeah. And I also think that we're going to learn a lot about biology here. Like, not just about SARS-CoV-2 and COVID. Like, this is going to teach us about like how we deal, how our bodies respond to stuff.
Yeah, right. It's funny how much we're learning about stuff I feel like we should have already known. by the way, Zach, as an aside, this Dr. Ziad Alali that he was just mentioning, I invited him to come on and do an episode with me and Dave Anthony of The Dollop. And he was like, yeah, totally. And then I think he looked at Dave Anthony and I's Twitter pages and was like, nope. And just ghosted me. It's like the second time that's ever happened to me in all my years of doing the show. So anyways, okay. So let's get back to some of this, some of the new information coming out. You alluded to this new study from the Lancet Infectious Diseases that talked about long COVID and the evidence of this persistent viral material. Can you tell us a little bit about that study and what it might mean?
Yeah, this is an amazing study in Lancet Infectious Diseases. Basically, here's what they did. Bunch of patients in China got a mild COVID. This was not very severe COVID, by the way. That's also an important part of this. Vaccinated, Omicron era. And so this is a different kettle of fish than, you know, that we're dealing with Zach. And it's like, okay, after their recovery phase, they were scheduled for some reason to have like a biopsy or a surgery 1, 2, or 4 months later. And they were like, hey, while we're in there, let's just get a bunch of samples. And which is just, that's very cool in a way. I just thank you to the researchers and the patients who like signed up for that. And they looked for viral genetic material, RNA, in these patients. And they looked for signs that there were proteins that those RNA actually might be the code for. And they then asked all these patients to fill out surveys at 4 months saying, do you have any of these symptoms, which are, you know, on the greatest hit list of long COVID, right? And so they try to correlate all that. And what they found was, on one hand, they found, okay, in some patients at 1 month, less at 2 months and less at 4 months, there was indeed persistent genetic material, RNA, being found in very small amounts. But it's there. Now, that alone is like, we could do an hour on this, because RNA has a very short half-life. It should just disintegrate very quickly. This tells me the immune system is chaperoning it. It's keeping it around on purpose for some reason. Now, again, to a good effect or bad effect, that's the question. Then they looked and they were like, oh, by the way, are they making proteins with this? And the answer was, yep. The places they found like spike protein in the lungs in those patients were the ones that had this persistent RNA. So that RNA is not just, you know, a little fragment. It's getting turned into protein that looks like the virus. So no kidding, that could cause a symptom, right? Because it's like our immune system is what makes symptoms.
I'm sorry, real quick. Along those lines, what's really interesting to me is that you know, our traditional thought is that RNA, once you get it in the body, it quickly dissolves and denatures and you're done with it. And that's when we see that with the vaccines, right? It's one of the arguments about people when they say it's gene therapy. And we're like, no, it's the RNA itself is only in you for a very short period of time.
Yeah.
I mean, but that is the case, correct? We don't see like vaccine RNA sticking around. It seems to be very particular to this virus, at least the first time we've seen it.
We've never seen vaccines do this, but I also don't think we've checked in that particular way, to be honest. And remember, this is small amounts. This is like, you know, when you have a PCR test, when you test your nose, when you have an acute infection, it'd be like 10 to the ninth, you know, this would be like single digit numbers of copies. This is a very small amount. So we're talking micro. So I don't actually know. It's very possible that we do keep that RNA around, but again, it doesn't get into your DNA, but it just might hang out in cells for a little while. And again, it seems to be going down and down over time, so that by 4 months, there's really very little left, if any. In most patients, it's gone. So I'm going to be humble and say it's possible that our vaccines do this as well on some level. And again, but the question is, where is the needle? Is it a benefit or a harm? So,
yeah. Well, yeah, you would think it would be, if it did stick around, you think it would be a very useful thing, but to my knowledge, everything that we've seen is that it doesn't, but, there are still things that we are learning about it.
But in like the flu literature and the measles literature, they have shown like, look, having this persistent little amount of genetic material around seems to keep memory cells factory going. So it could actually be, interesting, but again, I think that, you know, it's no good if you're laid out. So, you know, it's like, I mean, we talk about this in chemotherapy, in bone marrow transplants. You want some degree, if you have a blood cancer and you get a bone marrow transplant, you do not want what's called graft versus host disease. That is like a rejection. Like the freaking bone marrow that you put in your body is attacking you like crazy. But it turns out that a little bit of graft versus host disease is really good because it knocks out the remaining cells of your cancer. So again, I just think that's where I think we're headed.
Hmm. Okay. Are you a little worried that with that discussion that RNA fragments can last, that it might be something used by people who are against the vaccine, anti-vaxxers, to not use it? Because we see a lot of hope with these RNA vaccines. I'm a big fan of what I've seen so far. Do you think this is something that they're going to cling to, that they're going to take out of context?
Well, first of all, again, I haven't seen that the vaccines do that, but it doesn't mean they don't. I mean, I don't know that. And I would say that my sort of guiding principle is, you know what, follow the science. I know that so far the mRNA vaccines have saved millions and millions and millions of lives. Everything's a risk benefit. If we find some risk down the road that we didn't know about, it's going to be a big steep uphill climb until it's even close, you know, like, right. I mean, it's just like, these things have saved millions of lives. Do I worry about people misusing science? Yeah, they do it all the time. They do it all the time. but I just rather know what's going on. And again, I will say that this, even though the literature is pretty strong on this, I've talked to very, very few immunologists who have put all this together. I mean, I have talked to a few and they're like, yeah, that sounds really good, but that's not where the field is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, was there any correlation between the patients having it in their finding fragments still at 4 months, and their symptoms? Were they able to determine that?
The answer is yes, which was pretty staggering. But I will say that the flip side of that was that decreased with time. So in other words, yes, there was a correlation between if you had the genetic material hanging around for 1, 2, or 4 months, you were much more likely to have long COVID symptoms. But the increased risk of that was off the charts high at 1 month, was lower at 2 months, and was actually statistically not even significant at 4 months. So that's why I said that the first two theories I mentioned are sort of, it may go hand in hand, you know? Mm-hmm.
So explain this to me. I was reading your Substack and you had a quote in there, and I think it relates to this, and I'm maybe you can explain some of the details of this to us and to Zach. I know it all. I understand it, but Zach needs you to explain this. To date, no one has isolated a live replicating virus in the post-acute phase of SARS-CoV-2 infection. There is evidence of persistent viral antigens and indirect evidence of persistently activated T cells months or years after the infection. You're not the one who said that, but tell me what that quote means.
I was like, I did not say anything nearly that smart.
You didn't say that. But tell me what that quote means, what it's saying.
It's saying that, okay, yes, we have found persistent, small amounts of persistent RNA, genetic material of SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID, in these tissues months out. That does not mean that it's actually a live replicating virus. In other words, it's not like your viral loads go high and low. There aren't viral particles that have been cultured and growing. And I think the last part you said was...
Yeah, there is evidence of persistent viral antigens and indirect evidence of persistently activated T cells.
Yes. So the antigens are like the proteins, like the spike protein, which is the surface of the virus by itself hanging around, not intact, what we call virions, like the little, if you see like a picture of like a cartoon or like an electron micrograph of like what a little virus looks like, not the whole thing, but like just a little thing off of it, you know, little
pieces off the surface of it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they're finding. And what the quote is saying is that, that the memory, the T cells and the B cells, these are the part of our immune systems that remember for a long time, so that when it comes back, if you get another infection in the future, that's what gets activated to ramp up new antibodies from basically from scratch. And so what's being said is that like we are creating memory, which is a good thing. We don't want to not create memory to this thing. Mm-hmm. But we see that those cells are activated for a long time, possibly by this sort of longer lasting proteins that are hanging out.
I would have said this. That would have been my answer too. Just so you know, Kaveh, that's what I was thinking. I wrote it down. That's word for word.
No doubt. No cap, as the kids say.
All right. So, Jeremy, for someone, and obviously not me and not anyone on this call, but, you know, someone who might accidentally find this podcast who doesn't understand biology, what the fuck does that mean?
Oh, right.
Let me start by asking, you feel like, Zach, you didn't do pre-med. You're not like a science nerd. You're a nerd in another fashion. So don't take that as an insult. I am wearing
an Encino Man t-shirt.
That's pretty cool, nerd. You're cool, nerd. We're not cool, nerd. But do you feel like during this process you've learned about some of these terms like B cell and T cell? Do you know what those are? And if not, can we explain them to you? And by we, I mean Jeremy.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I know T cell because I am a Resident Evil fan, so I'm aware of the T virus. But outside of that, I know very little biology as a whole. I'm going in cold to most of these things, but so it's good to listen to stuff like this, but it's also, I think there's a lot of people who are in the same seat as me who will then not seek out the answer and not try to understand just write it off as, well, obviously we can't trust these doctors. They're pushing an agenda. So,
because we're using language that's hard to decipher. That's for sure. Yeah. I mean, Jeremy, how would you, I mean, in terms of using the cells, I don't think it's that important that we talk about like T cell and B cell for people who aren't like in the world of medicine. I don't think that people need to know those terms. Yeah. But I will say, I think the concept we have to be able to share with people is that the body has ways of keeping a memory of what it sees. Yeah. And that's really tying in. And there's reasons it would want to do that. It would want to have that memory of this virus around, because that way, if it ever needed to ramp up quickly, if it was exposed to it again, it could do so, and it could fight that illness better. But what it sounds like is there's a potential for here is that the body might be keeping a little bit more than it needs, or it's keeping some and it's having some backfires because of it. And some of that we're getting from this retained stuff might be causing some of the long COVID symptoms. Does that make sense, Zach?
Yeah, no, it does. It's an immune system overreaction to what happened. Mm-hmm. I think would be the way that would make sense to me.
Like, so for example, let me see, I'm gonna try something here. You guys both correct me if I'm wrong. So say like someone has a memory of someone like hitting them when they're young. And they are like, okay, well, I'm not going to, it's good to know to some degree to not talk to like that stranger that like hit me. But then maybe you have a little much too PTSD about it. And that it makes it hard to talk to like people because you're always worried about some stranger hitting you again. So it's like, it's good to have a little bit of fear, but well, you can't let it keep you from talking to people in the future.
No, this is really good. I would amend it. I'd be like,
okay, let's workshop
this.
You got
your butt kicked. Yeah. And then you went and you juiced and went to the gym and you started working out so you could fight back. Right. And now someone like
bumps into you.
And then you beat the shit out of them.
Right.
Except it's your own immune system doing it to your body.
Right. Does that check out, Zach?
That does. That makes perfect sense.
We're talking about like these, you know, the concern that like listeners would go, oh, these doctors, they're pushing up in their shills. Let me tell you one thing. The only thing I've ever seen in any medical literature that like high quality literature that actually helped prevent long COVID is a drug called metformin, which costs like 40 cents, which I don't even prescribe. You know, like there's no circumstance in which I as an ER doctor prescribe it. So it's like, I'm really not doing myself any favors by saying metformin is the thing. It's an off patent drug that everyone has access to that I don't make any money from. Oh, well.
Well, speaking of shilling, I am going to shill so hard for these ads that are coming your way. Stay tuned and I'll be right back with Dr. Jeremy Faust and non-doctor Zach Van Nuss. Stay.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Doomed. And we're back, and I hope you enjoyed those ads and/or. Let's get back to the subject of long COVID. There was something in that recent Lancet study that was a bit surprising, and it was the finding regarding immunocompromised patients. Can you explain what was surprising and maybe why?
Sure. This study, again, enrolled people who were pretty sick to begin with. They were getting a biopsy for usually some kind of cancer evaluation. So I think like 30-40% of the patients had cancer or something else. And anyway, but there were some who were immune compromised on chemotherapy, and the association between having symptoms of long COVID and having like immune compromise didn't go the direction that I would have thought, right? Like, the way I would have thought was like, oh, you're immune compromised. Like, you're at a higher risk of long COVID because your immune system just doesn't do what it's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out that the association, it wasn't statistically significant, but it was several times they looked at it. It was like, people who were immune compromised were less likely to have symptoms of long COVID, which I think was somewhat surprising. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting. I mean, it comes down to the fact of like, there's so much we don't know about some basic stuff. Like, why would, when we get a viral illness, is it the virus? Is it our response to it? What's the interplay of those things that cause our symptoms? It's stuff I feel like we should have a better hand. Why don't we have a better handle on this, Dr. Faust?
Well, I think that it's, COVID is a very prevalent virus, which is giving us, unfortunately, an opportunity to learn about something, you know, imagine you're trying to learn about Ebola, not a wonderful virus, but it's kind of like right now not easy to find patients with Ebola. That's a very good thing.
Yeah.
But like it's not that hard to find patients with COVID or with long COVID. They're everywhere. So I think that we have both an interest and the microscope is out and we have the prevalence to do these kinds of studies. I think that the immune compromised story it's a fascinating one. People who are immune compromised don't clear the virus very well. Maybe they don't make that much immune memory to it either. That could explain all of this. Like if they get infected a year from now, they're not going to do well because they don't have that immunity, mm-hmm. which is why they didn't have as much long COVID 4 months down the road. Maybe mm-hmm. they had a really shitty 2 months, but mm-hmm. by the 4 month time, they were sort of over it. So I just think, yeah, I think the reason we haven't learned all this is sort of the same thing that like people say, oh, how come this vaccine was so fast? You know, it usually takes 10, 20 years to make a vaccine. Why did y'all get it in a year? And it's like, because we had hundreds of millions of people who had it and we could randomize them to placebo or vaccine. And the outcome was like 14 days. So yeah, unfortunately it was easy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but let me ask you this, like, I know we can't compare this to the common cold and other viruses that we're exposed to all the time, but there are viruses out there that are ubiquitous that if we wanted to study rhinovirus in more depth, we could. What's the reason for not doing that? Just because it's just not as deadly and people aren't as concerned about it. There's no money in it. Well, what's the reason we aren't studying? Why do we not have a cure for the common cold?
Well, I mean, I think that the best correlate to ask is about other coronaviruses. Like there are a handful of other coronaviruses that are sort of endemic that have been around for a long time. And I suspect that each of them started like this, like they went nova, like mm-hmm. when they jumped from some species, you know, 200 years ago and caused some crazy outbreak that, you know, back in the day in 1600, they couldn't like, there weren't epidemiologists to like chase it around and just work through everyone and they all died or, you know, got immunity. I think that those coronaviruses probably all do this too, but it's just to a lesser extent. Yeah. So we've got immunity to it. We've got experience. They might be somewhat attenuated. In other words, there's always a trade-off between the more contagious a virus is. A virus is really, really like evolution puts a pressure on it to become more contagious.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In fact, it may be a little, not really any pressure to become less deadly. But but the perfect virus in terms of just like going viral is extremely contagious, asymptomatic. Because then you just go spread it to everyone and you don't even know it. You don't even bother to stay home. You just go about your business. That's a perfect virus. Yeah. So I think that the reason we haven't studied these other ones is that this one is, we're still so close to the nova that it causes the most death, the most ammonia, the most heart failure exacerbations, the most diabetes, like misery, missed days of work, long COVID, long post-acute sequela, we call it. You know, it's just everything you would find in those viruses, this one is doing times 100 right now.
Right, right.
And I really hope that between a combination of immunity and knowledge that it someday will be like that, but we're a long way off.
Right.
Yeah, it's still the squeakiest wheel.
By so far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Squeakiest, most dangerous, annoying wheel.
I really feel like we're present at like the birth of an explosion, like a nova. You know, that's really how mm-hmm. I feel about it. And it's like,
in terms of like knowledge about,
no, I mean, like, in terms of, like, the destruction, like, just like a star blowing up, you know, like, just, like, bad. Get it. You don't want to be near that.
Mm. So you think there's worse coming? Is that what you mean?
No, I'm saying, like, we just observed, like, 4 years ago, this like, cataclysmic event. And we're, like, in the fallout zone now.
Right.
But, you know, it's not like we're very far away from it.
Yeah, right, right. And also, I mean, there's multiple viruses that give, quote unquote, the common cold as opposed to this one thing that we're able to focus on. That makes sense. Let me shift gears a little bit and let's talk about some other long COVID related stuff. Let's start by talking about Paxlovid. What is the latest data on Paxlovid, its efficiency, who does well with it, who should use it, et cetera?
Yeah. So Paxlovid is antiviral. And when it first came out, the data were awesome. Pre-vaccine, it was just like unbelievably effective in decreasing mortality. It's just incredible. As time has gone on, we haven't gotten a lot of data recently, but the best we can see is that it's still working. But actually, like in that sort of supernova analogy, the rate of severe disease, like in old folks, is going down. Like in 2020, like 15 to 20% of seniors would have like severe disease, meaning they'd be in like close to the ICU.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like 1% of seniors will have that, you know? So Paxlovid might still cut that in half or even 80% or something like that. It could, but instead of it going from 1 in 5 to like 1 in 100, it goes from like 1 in 100 to 1 in 300. It's like not that many people. So I think that then, but the problem is that Paxlovid is very expensive now. So that's what I, you know, I wrote a paper recently about, like, who is it worth it for, like, in terms of, like, economics. There's a big study that's going to come out sometime this year out of the UK, where they actually, in the vaccine era, randomized patients to either get Paxlovid or not. And I suspect they're going to find it doesn't work that well anymore the way we thought it did. Either it's going to be a negative study, or it's going to be a study that's positive. But again, the so few people have serious disease, you know, without it, that it's like not that many at bats, if you will. So that's it. And then for long COVID, you know, so far we're just waiting. There's a study that was canceled at Stanford that we're pretty sure because it wasn't working. There are a couple of other studies coming down the pipeline, one at Yale, and then another one. I don't know who did it, but it's a big group. It might be the NIH related. I can't remember. I don't want to misspeak. Okay. So I think the Paxlovid for long COVID stuff, there's been some observational studies that have shown maybe a hint of this helping, but I think that I'm a little bit bearish on that. I'm not too optimistic, unfortunately.
But you feel like the thing about it is that you feel like it was very useful when the diseases were a certain way. There's a more severity of disease. And now it may just not be, it may need to be closer, it may need to be some closer evaluation of whether or not a patient should take it or not. Is that kind of what I'm hearing? Or do you think it's still worth most people who are of the age range or have the comorbidities, the risk factors to take it? Because I still would recommend people of a certain age, advanced age, and people with comorbidities to take it. It hasn't changed your recommendations yet, has it?
Not like my like official recommendations, but a little bit like the, in terms of like the degree of side eye I might give somebody if they told me that they were not going to take it, you know, like if one of my in-laws were like, you know, 2-3 years ago before a vaccine, be like, I'm not going to take it. I'd be like, well, I hope you like the ICU. See you later. You know, like you're, well, so now if they say I'm not going to take it, they've had COVID twice, you know, and you know, a zillion boosters probably.
I'm like meh.
I'm like, well, you know, technically the CDC says you qualify, but I don't see a lot of patients who meet your description who end up really in trouble. So, you know, I think the bigger thing is it's the year 2024. The CDC has not really changed what they call high risk. And they should, because there's a really high risk cohort who probably still needs this drug. You know, immune compromised folks, older folks, people with, you know, advanced, you know, super advanced, oldest old, or other, you know, conditions who like really need this drug, and others who, you know, take it or leave it in terms of, you know, as far as we know. But again, there's still much to learn.
What about people who have severe long COVID symptoms? If they are reinfected, do you recommend that they take it?
I haven't thought about that question. That's a really good one.
Asking for myself or anything.
Oh, no. <You know. laughs> Yeah. I don't have data on that. It's a data-free zone. But if I were being like completely irresponsible and giving you advice on that, I would say like, yeah, I might. You know, I might. And but I always tell people like the research studies are really generalizable to like the very specific population that's been studied, and everyone we don't know so much. And so like, for example, the low risk people were finally studied and Pfizer gave us the data, and it turned out doesn't help them, you know? So I was like, yeah, stop giving it to like the worried well who were like, you know, young and affluent and yada, yada, yada. But like high risk, really high risk, young, it does help. And so we have no idea. So if it were me and I were you, I might take it for more than 5 days. You know, I think there is like whispers around that there's data that like maybe 10 days is really better than five, you know? So I'm not giving that as a recommendation. I'm just saying there's much to learn here. And I wouldn't, just because I haven't seen any study that said, oh, you know, someone who meets your description, I haven't seen a study that supports Paxlovid. I haven't seen one that doesn't either. And it makes some sense to me.
Jeremy, I feel like you are a public health insider. You know the people, you know the players.
I'm a thorn in their side. I call them. I'm like, tell me stuff.
It's something I love about you.
And I don't get invited to meetings, but then they tell me what happened. I'm like, it's perfect.
But so let me ask you this. So I feel like the problem here, more than maybe we've seen since AIDS, HIV, is the politics that are incorporated into making decisions and announcements and recommendations. Do you feel like that's still the case? Do you feel like the CDC, do you feel like national institutions are hampered with what should be the recommendations based on what might be politics from either side, people from people who may be downplaying it to overplaying it? I don't know. Like, do you feel like that's still a factor? Because I feel like it certainly was.
I feel like the politics do have an influence on the recommendations, but I do think that lately the recommendations are a little bit less, I don't say important, but like, again, it's like the sci-fi, like it's a little less meaningful, you know, like, mm-hmm. Oh, if you're not going to get your fifth dose compared to your fourth dose, you know, like, I don't know what that means compared to like going from 0 to 2, right. You know? So it's like, I think there's like a little bit of like, the CDC and the FDA's, bent is like more. And I think that's probably influenced a little bit by a sort of political, not political agenda, but just almost like a philosophical way of looking at things. But I will, in their defense, I would say that they feel that they can say nothing of nuance. And am right. I allowed to discuss, you know, Star Trek The Next Generation on this show? Can I do it?
Oh God, yeah, sure, if you want. I mean, that's the one with the lightsabers and the...
Yeah.
No, it's not. Sorry, go on.
The sandworms. It's the sandworms.
It's the one with the sandworms, right?
Yeah.
With the mildly coated Arabs. Oh, that's the one are we talking about? Is that a different show?
Star Trek has a little bit of offensive for everybody. And yet it's a future of harmony. Anyway, there's this great episode where they're in a time loop and they can't get out of it, and they start to figure out how to send messages from one loop to the next, but they can only send like one like very small amount of information. And in one of the loops, they send the number 3. And then what happens at the key moment is the guy at the helm realizes, listen to the guy with the 3 buttons, not the guy with the 4 buttons. And then they get out of the loop. And I feel like the CDC like says like, we can say one thing, take it, do it.
Right.
They can't be like, well, if you have high risk and low risk, or if you've been infected before, or if you, they can't get into that because they're like, people will listen to maybe 3 characters of information from us.
Yeah.
And so that's, so I, as much as I'm like, oh, why are their recommendations like so not nuanced? I think that's why.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, describing what we're in as a time loop would explain a lot of stuff that's happening now. All right. We should close up soon, but I do want to end with one last topic, which was you recently did a short TED Talk rebuttal. What was it? And could you tell us a little bit about what that was a rebuttal to, and a little bit about what you said?
Sure. Yeah. So I went to TED in Vancouver, which is like the main TED. There's like these like TEDx and TED this and TED that. But apparently for a lot of money, which I did not have to pay because that was a gift from somebody, I got to go to like the TED, and they had like lots of famous people speaking, and like, it was really, really cool. Anyway, there was a talk. Should I say who it was?
I don't know. You absolutely should.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
She's not listening.
Yeah, it was Barry Weiss, and Barry gave a talk about like being contrarian and how like it shouldn't be controversial that I think this and yet it is. It shouldn't be controversial that I believe this and yet it is. And then she like spent like in 15 minutes of her talk, she spent like 1 minute on COVID, and everything she said was wrong. And I was like, oh, brutal. That means the other 14 minutes are probably wrong too, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know about those things, right? So
it's a safe guess.
Yeah.
I mean, but go on.
So,
the
yeah.
part you did know for sure.
Yeah. At least the part that I did know, I was like, oh, jeez. So then you can like go on the app and like and like submit like a little request, like a proposal to spend 90 seconds on stage sort of rebutting what you heard. So I wrote out what I would say, and they let me go up there. And it was about mental health. And basically she was like blaming all of our mental health problems that we have today on COVID mitigation, on like the shutdown, on the schools being closed. She said schools were closed for 2 years. I'm like, even in San Francisco, you know, they weren't closed for 2 years.
Yeah.
Like, come on, let's at least get the facts right. And so I just kind of went up there and I said, look, you know, we've got mental health problems, and the pandemic didn't help. But to lay blame of that, of our mental health problems on our response to literally like the largest mortality event in modern history, is just not data-driven and not appropriate.
You did me and Tyler Black, friend of the show and suicidologist, very proud. It was a great response. It was a very important response. And I'm glad that you did it because I thought you were very well spoken. You did a good job with that.
Thank you.
Zach, any last questions for Dr. Faust?
I would like to ask about the mental health effects. I am a lifelong depression sufferer, a somewhat frequent suicidal ideology sufferer. This is actually what Kaveh and I talked about when he was on my podcast. We accidentally got into it. For me,
I straight up asked him. I asked that every show I go on. I asked, I want to know if they have suicidal or homicidal ideation. It's just the first thing I ask.
Yeah, no homicidal on my end. I don't want to hurt anyone else. So good at least I've got that going for me.
Good of you.
But I have seen people even flip of saying getting COVID, one of the long-term symptoms of COVID is increased depression, increased rates of anger and like suicidal ideation. Is that something you have seen any sort of data on that is like, oh yeah, no, this is actually affecting us? Because I agree, 2020 was a terrible year all around. Like the world was uprooted in ways that none of us were prepared for. Yeah. Just societally as a whole, everything was falling apart. So of course it had a mental health toll on people. But I don't think COVID is the reason. I don't think closing schools was the reason.
Right. So I think people do forget that depression existed before COVID and that kids didn't love being in high school.
Yeah.
Like John Hughes' entire output is about angsty teenagers, right? Like, and I'm not trying to downplay like mental health, but like it's a thing that's been, and I think social media has been a real detriment. And yet, not one size fits all. Some people, social media is a real boon for them. They're less isolated. It's really complicated. And I think to your point, like, I think that one of the pieces of data that I referenced in my little mini talk was that, yeah, young people did express mental health stressors during the pandemic, but it wasn't about isolation most of the time. It was more about like, are my parents okay? Are my grandparents okay? Like grieving, mourning and worrying about the health of people you care about, less about like, you know, telecommuting to school. And again, I still stay, look, I spent a lot of time thinking about next time. I think we got to get the schools open sooner next time. Like that's a big priority. But like, that ain't why we have problems. And in terms of like your question, and in fact, actually suicidal thoughts in teen girls went up, in lockstep with schools reopening, not with the closing. It was like,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And suicide deaths went down during the shutdown because suicide is a act of impulse and it's an act of opportunity. And people were all stuck together and they're watching each other. And so that's what happened there. You know, I can't cite chapter and verse about depression, suicide, and long COVID, but I will say that, it wouldn't surprise me, because I think that, you know, some of the most common things people think about when they think about long COVID, they think about brain fog, fatigue, you know, lack of just the energy to do stuff. So which kind of sounds like on the trajectory to a medical term we call anhedonia, like just like not feeling like getting joy out of stuff or not the opportunity to. And so I think that those may be feeding into each other. I also think that we see in a certain patient population, the ones who were like in the ICU for a long time, who had a long, long kind of physical therapy recovery, those folks have a big mental health piece because it's like, wow, I may not walk again. So that's really hard for people to work their way through. I have yet to see really strong data on this, but it just wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. And thank you for reminding us that high school students have angst, or Trent Reznor wouldn't have had such a successful career. So on a serious note, I will say this, though, in regards to the suicide ideation stuff, I know it's an uncomfortable topic for people out there, but I do think it's the kind of thing you should ask people if you think that's really even a small concern. And a lot of people don't want to discuss it because, one, it's really awkward, and two, you're afraid you're going to plant the seed of them committing suicide in their head. You're not going to.
No, it's not how it works.
It's not how it works, but addressing it and being open about it, discussing it, and helping people get to the right places to get help, I think is really important. So I am glad you shared that with me, and I'm glad that you shared with me that you're also, you know, getting the right help, and you're something that's a big part of your life. That is something that we need to talk about.
No, and to what you said, Kaveh, like, if you think someone is at risk, you asking them can be the thing that saves them. Like I told you, I am here because my wife checked in. Yeah. Like, that's the only reason I am still alive right now, because she saw something was wrong and she asked the question. So it's so important, because it's super uncomfortable. Not for me anymore. I talk about it. I mean, I managed to bring it up on an episode about COVID, so I talk about it all the time. Mm-hmm. It's Mental Health Awareness Month is May.
Yeah.
So every episode of my podcast this month is about mental health. So, like, I talk about it all the time, but it's because I think there's so much stigma around it. And as a person who's comfortable talking about it, I feel like it's my job to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So people feel more and more comfortable. Because if I don't say something, he won't shut up about it. So let's just go ahead and put it out there.
This man won't shut up until you all stop having suicidal ideation. Yeah. So he's going to keep at it, which is good.
Yeah, it's funny. I, at work, we ask all the time, you know, just like, it's almost like a checklist, you know, and I try to ask in like a way that makes it seem like it's not a checklist, but you know, it's just like you ask it. And I can tell that to me, it feels like it, because when I ask it, I don't feel any sense of nerves. It's just something I just say.
Yeah.
But outside of the hospital, it is so different. Like, and I can tell you, I have probably asked, I can think of two, but maybe there's a third I'm not thinking of, times in my life when I asked someone outside of my medical life, like, hey, do you have access to like a firearm? Like, is there any chance you would hurt yourself? And it was like the hardest thing I've ever done, even though I asked those same questions in the hospital every day.
Yeah.
Super easy at work to do, super hard to do in your life. And so I would just say, anyone listening, like, if you're worried about someone, I would just echo what you said, ask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Worst case scenario, they just tell you you've misread the situation and they're fine. Like, that's that's the worst thing that could happen, is that you just misread it, but they still know that you care about them.
Yeah.
yeah, well said. Well, speaking of where people can hear you talk about this, Zach, where can people hear you talk about this?
You can find me on Grinding to a Halt. It releases every Tuesday. I'm on some variation of Grinding to a Halt or Grind_pod on all socials, or grindingtoahalt.com. You know,
he's also on an app called Grindr, I believe.
I've been trying to
corner the market on that. Yeah.
There's a lot of interest. It hasn't yet equated to listening to the podcast, but messages.
Jeremy, where, by the way, listen to the show, listen to Grinding to a Halt, and listen to my episode on it first, and then go from there. Jeremy, I'm a big fan of your work. I'm a big fan of your writing. I'm a big fan of your face. I'm a big fan of you, buddy. Where can people get Inside Medicine? Where can people get it, and where else can they find you?
So Inside Medicine is my Substack. It's insidemedicine.substack.com. And I write basically 2-3 days a week for free about data, stuff happening in medicine and health. And then on the weekends, I do a little like behind the scenes, like how I think about being an ER doc, which is for the premium folks. So that's how I make a little coinage there, because it's a lot of work. It's a labor of love to do these deep dives, and I'll cover COVID, I'll cover whatever's in the news, and I take requests. And I'm also on, I guess I'm still on Twitter at Jeremy Faust, and on Instagram at Jeremy Samuel Faust, Threads. But mostly, if you're finding me on social media, I'm probably just talking about Survivor, the reality TV show.
I want to say your Substack is the only Substack that I actually read at this point. Oh, no, two. I mean, Jen Gunter has one and yours, and that's about it. And you have a really well-paced, well, like, thought out writing style, and you don't write so much that it becomes hard to take in one sitting. You can read your thing in one sitting and you can take something from it. You can always take a couple of good learning points from it, and myself included. So I do recommend it, highly recommend it. Thank you both so very, very much for coming on the show. It was super fun to have you both here. If you haven't already, rate and review us at iTunes. I love reading them. It helps get new listeners to the show. I'm really close to beating Brett Weinstein in the top Spotify podcast. Help me beat that guy. Really, I want to beat that guy so bad. So bad, please. Anyways, Love you all. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.